Welcome to the Learning Reinvented podcast, brought to you by myself, James Politilo, and the team from The Learning Effect. There are lots of learning podcasts out there, so we wanted to do something slightly different. In this episode, we're looking at how you can employ agile approaches into your HR and learning practices. To share her expertise, practical experience and views, we are joined by Nabel Crowhurst. Nabel, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, James. Great to be here.
I really appreciate you taking some time to join us today, Nabel. Do you want to start by introducing yourself to our listeners and telling them a little bit about you and your background?
I can. So my name's Nabel. I am Chief People Officer at a company called Reward Gateway. And at Reward Gateway, we partner with HR leaders and organisations for solutions around their employee engagement, communications, employee benefits and well-being. So I'm in a very fortunate role whereby I do HR for a business that does HR, which is really cool. And we've got a fantastic culture within the business and some great people that I get to work with doing some really creative and new initiatives in the world of HR. So my experience kind of spans lots of different industries, different size and scale organisations, worked in the airline industry, worked in retail, worked in pharmaceuticals, in education, all sorts. And across all of those different businesses, in some respects, you face similar challenges. And in others, there are nuances dependent on what industry you're in. And one of the areas that I feel really passionately about is how we can utilise agile principles and how they apply, regardless of what type of organisation you're in, and how they help us deliver great work in HR and how we support the organisations we work within.
And I know you've had that diverse background in terms of different sectors or industries that you've worked in, but also as a Chief People Officer, you've come up the learning and development route, which isn't necessarily typical. There are people who come up that route, but you know, it doesn't tend to be the traditional way to get to a CPO role. So how do you think that learning background enhances your CPO role, and what challenges does it create for you?
Yeah, I'm not a typical CPO, I don't think. But then I guess what is typical? I suppose everybody's unique in their own way. And certainly my HR career did start in learning and development, which was a real joy for me. If I go back early on in my career, I don't think in those L&D days, I ever thought that I'd be in the position that I'm in today. I'm not quite sure sometimes how that happened. But it's been a really, really great journey and kind of career experience for me. But I think where I lean to in the role that I do now is very much around people experience. So when I'm thinking about what we do in our people team and how we support in our organisation, it's that experience-led focus. Of course, you have a responsibility when you're overseeing a HR function and a people team to you know, have the right policies and processes in place, and we do things in the right way, legally and all those kind of things. But my lean tends to be much more towards what's the overall employee life cycle. How do we make sure that we've got a really fantastic employee value proposition? And what does the employee experience look like overall? And I think that probably stems from having come from that L&D space, because, you know, when you're in L&D, your focus is about enabling people to grow and thrive and be the best that they can be. And so that's evolved over my career to where I am today.
And I know we're going to talk and touch upon agile as part of that. And, you know, that's something that's built into that practice, that it creates those employee experiences, that deals with everything that you're doing in the business. Now, agile is one of those phrases that people will probably have heard of, but again, some people may not know what it is. So can you bring that to life for people?
Yeah, I think for some people, they might hear the term agile and think that that refers to kind of flexibility, nimble decision making, and maybe even the way in which they approach their sort of hybrid or flexible working approaches in an organization. For me, agile is far greater than that. So agile practices and agile methodologies actually started decades ago in the software development and tech space. And as that's progressed over the last few decades, lots of other areas of organisations have seen that some of the practices and principles that were being used in software development could just as well be applied to other areas of a business. So for me, it's much more a methodology. It's an approach to work. It's a series of different techniques that you can use that enable you to be able to make better decisions around how you prioritize the work that you deliver into a business. It enables you to deliver solutions that are more aligned to what the business needs, because it encourages regular feedback loops, so that you are staying very much aligned to perhaps business changes as you're designing and creating solutions to support and enable a business. And it also creates a very different mindset. So Agile talks a lot about self-organized teams. So removing traditional hierarchy and encouraging autonomy and empowerment in people in the way in which they show up to work, and having much more kind of shared collaboration with the way in which they deliver their work. So it's a whole methodology and a whole approach to how we do what we do.
And that's really helpful to sort of give those parameters of the methodology, the thinking, self-organized teams, lots of different things encompassed in there. Can you give us some specific examples of how you've applied that agile approach to help improve the practice you're doing, or help improve the teams or businesses you're working in?
Yeah, I think Agile is such a broad spectrum of different techniques and methodologies you can use. And there's a whole kind of language that sort of sits behind it. So all the different principles have got a kind of name, and that can feel a bit daunting if you're not familiar with that side of things. And I think what's really important is, if you're curious enough to understand a bit more about what Agile is, that you do some research and you perhaps pick out one or two of those methodologies that get you started, and you start small and you experiment and you try working in different ways. So a couple of really good examples are when I've been working on projects with the team, and sometimes with projects it can feel quite lengthy and cumbersome to actually get from the start of a project to the conclusion of a project and deliver something out to the business. If you apply the simple principle of breaking down a project into much shorter time boxed periods of time, and at each of those points of time, you introduce the idea of having feedback loops from your stakeholder group in the business to make sure that you're able to adapt and change perhaps what you're delivering. The reality is you end up not only delivering a better solution, but you tend to do it faster. And so without going too much into the, you know, different kind of vocabulary of Agile, that particular part of Agile working is a principle called sprints. So you're working in short sprints. You're agreeing up front the things that you're going to deliver in your shorter period of time. And those shorter periods of time tend to maybe be a week or 2 weeks. At the end of that week or 2 weeks, you have a review period where you come together as a team, you reflect and have a kind of retrospective conversation, say what worked well and what didn't work well and how do you move forward. And just that practice enables the pace of work to happen much more efficiently. If you think about a project in its traditional sense, more often than not, you start your project and you probably have some kind of enormous Gantt chart or waterfall plan in a traditional project management approach. You probably then have a monthly project meeting, and the likelihood is that during the month you do very little of the tasks that need to get done for that project until a day before the project meeting, where you're supposed to be reporting back on everything you've achieved, and you think, shit, I haven't done everything I needed to do. And you scrabble around so that you can show up to the meeting looking like you've done some work to deliver against the project. And the whole thing becomes very slow and cumbersome. And so certainly with projects, it's a great way of being able to get some momentum and enable work to be done much quicker than it would be if you were to go down the traditional route.
So bringing that into, you know, as you said, it's established in IT teams, lots, you know, most IT teams work in those sprints. You can still have that. Does it sometimes change the behavior of, again, you know, people being brought into that? And, you know, you've got, like, you use the end of the month analogy of people do everything last minute. I've seen that in sprint projects as well, whether you don't change the human behavior, you just make the time scale slightly shorter when people come into that for the first time. But how have you got people to really embrace the sort of methodology outside of IT in HR teams, and what specific areas has it worked in? So what projects has it delivered in, and are you using that, sorry, lots of questions at once, but are you using that more broadly than HR? Is it across the whole of a reward gateway, for example? Is it just the IT team and the HR teams, or has that become a company methodology?
Yeah, well, that is a lot of questions all in one go. Hold on, let's see if we can cover each one of them off. I think your first point actually touches into the principle of mindset. So I think one of the things that's really important if you are embarking on a journey of introducing agile principles, it's not just the process, it's the mindset that goes with it. And the mindset piece connects to how you show up and how people are led and managed in an organization, how you move away from a kind of directive, command and control type environment in a culture, more towards a collective responsibility for the work that needs to be done. So if you're a team of people working on a project, you have shared accountability for delivering everything in that project rather than the one or two things that you consider to be your area of expertise. And that time frame piece, then that kind of follow on question that you asked, which is, well, you're just changing the timelines of the same principle of having a meeting once a week rather than once a month, is that interspersed with that is the idea of having what's known as a daily stand up. So having a very brief meeting. So rather than your monthly project meeting that might be 3 hours, during your shorter time box period of time, every day, just having 15 minutes together to say, what have you done today? What did you do yesterday? What are you going to do today? And what blockers have you got? So that every day you've got an element of accountability to stand up and say, this is what I'm doing to contribute to this project, so that things don't get delayed and slowed down by people kind of hiding in the shadows and relying on other people to get stuff done in the team. So I think there's a couple of things there to take into consideration with how you operate if you decide to introduce these kind of principles. So specific projects, you know, one of the projects that kind of never goes away for HR teams, and one that, you know, time after time utilize these principles to make improvements, is onboarding. Onboarding never goes away. It's always something that you continually need to improve. And I think if you take a mindset of, oh, hey, we're going to improve onboarding, we're going to do a project, it's going to start today and it's going to end in 6 months, and then it's tick box, move on, that's not helpful, because even when you go a month in, 2 months in and 6 months in, there's still going to be a need for things to continually be improved and evolved. So if you take more of a philosophy of onboarding is an ongoing project that iteratively is improved continuously, and you do that in short bursts of activity, and for each of those bursts of activity, you're constantly asking for feedback from the business to understand what's working, what's not, where can we improve, that's a far better space to be in than saying to the business, we're doing an onboarding project, it'll be done in 6 months, and then onboarding's perfect forevermore, because it's just not. So they are, you know, the bigger principles, where you take a big chunky project like onboarding, or perhaps how you design your leadership and management development program, where you have a need from the business that says, yeah, okay, we need to design a management program, and where do we start? Well, we'll start here, and in a year's time we'll have delivered something great. And actually that's too long, and the requirements of the business might change as you go along. So it's either large scale projects, or you can start at the complete opposite end of the spectrum, where you simply say, actually, we want to work differently in terms of how we communicate as a team. So let's utilize the principles of a regular stand up. And instead of having a bi-weekly department meeting, we have a 15 minute check-in each day where we simply give a very short update to say what we've been up to, and we move on and we keep progressing forward with our work. And the difference in the methodologies and what you use tend to lend themselves to different areas of HR more effectively. So where you've got areas of HR, perhaps like learning and development, that have larger projects to deliver, some of the bigger principles kind of lend themselves well. Then you might have areas like people operations that are more reactive and responsive to work that's happening on a day-to-day basis, that don't tend to lean into project work. And in which case you can use some of the principles, but apply them slightly differently to how you show up each day as a team.
I think that's really helpful to bring it to life for people, because again, that application of principles sometimes into real work is where things fall down. So it's great to hear from someone who's using those practices, and like you said, adapting them for different parts of the HR function as well. And I think with all methodologies, adapting them to what suits with your organization. So, you know, you'll use the general methodology and everything else, but play up and down for certain parts of that within, as you said, L&D, longer term projects, people operations, you know, more reactive and responsive, but there's still principles you can take from that and apply. So I think that's great. One question I did want to ask you was, you talked about self-organized teams, and traditional HR is sort of driven by this hierarchy principle. Most HRISs are driven by hierarchy principles. So how do you sort of balance that in? So how have you managed the self-organized teams into maybe more traditional hierarchy, command and control structures, and some of the, I think, the infrastructure that keeps those things happening? Because sometimes reviews, rewards, mechanism, organizing, and again, things like systems can try and make that quite difficult. So I'd love to hear some of those things you've done to overcome that.
Yeah. It's a hard one because, you know, hierarchy is to some degree entrenched within organizations. So there's also a difference in my view between leadership and hierarchy. So to some degree, there's an element of hierarchy required because chances are we've got processes in our businesses where things need to be signed off and approved and those kind of things, right? And I'm not sure we're ready. You know, some businesses might be, but, you know, we're still going to need a little bit of that. How we show up as leaders and managers in our organisations is where I see the difference, and how you foster environments of empowerment and autonomy in the work that people do is what's key to shifting the mindset to how we get work done. But it can also be a case of how teams look at the work that they've got. So as an example, if you take an area like talent acquisition, if you've got an internal kind of talent acquisition team, and perhaps you're aligned to specific business units or business geographies, so each talent acquisition partner is responsible for a specific country or business unit, that's okay. But the reality is the volume of work that comes into each of those business units or business geographies will come in ebbs and flows. And you'll end up with one person that's massively busy because they've got a huge, you know, portfolio of roles that they're recruiting for, and then another area that's perhaps not so busy for a period of time. So what we've been looking at is, whilst we've got kind of key areas of responsibility as a sort of starting point, what then needs to happen is, when you've got a glut of work or a high volume of roles, as a team, the team come together and say, oh, hang on a second, we've got a whole load of roles going on in this particular area. That's not my area, but actually I've got capacity right now. Let me lean in, grab hold of some of those roles, and we balance the work between us all. And we look at that as a team collective, rather than either saying, well, that's not my area of responsibility, so I'll just leave you with that. Or say, not saying anything and waiting for a manager to come along and say, excuse me, but this person's really stretched. Could you pick up the work for this person? As a team, they should be self-organizing and reviewing the workload and being able to push and pull levers where they need to make sure it's managed more effectively. So that's a kind of practical example of where you can encourage the principle of self-organized teams in just general day-to-day work in a TA function.
And I think that's great. And having that collaborative team who are solving their problems, who are helping each other out, and creating that culture, you know, is again what I've tried to do in the teams that I've developed. But sometimes I've felt in the past I'm pushing against the organizational structure of, well, the, you know, we're driven by individual accountability, which doesn't drive team behavior sometimes, because, you know, I've got a set of objectives where my bonus is paid for. So it's just how you start to break down some of those bits, you know, because like you said, you're going to need hierarchy to sign off a purchase order or something like that, or to approve annual leave, or, you know, there's certain structures that might be there. But then sometimes that reward and recognition processes and some of those organizational leadership and management processes are the real things that stop that happening.
Yeah. And I think it's that point about kind of goals and measures, I think, is another area of consideration. So traditionally, you would probably say that if you're following a traditional performance management approach, it's that kind of setup where at the beginning of the year, we map out what's going to be delivered. There's a cascade of objectives through the business, and each individual lands on being given their, I don't know, 5 or 7 objectives that they've got to deliver by Christmas. The reality is the world evolves through that year. So how can you possibly set out goals that you're going to measure people against for a full year ahead and then suggest that their bonus is going to be paid out on it? It's just not realistic. So when you start to move away from kind of objective setting and formulaic kind of KPIs, and you move a bit more towards, in agile world, what's known as OKRs, so objectives and key results, and you look at shorter, again, it's this shorter time period, and perhaps you set OKRs that are more sort of on a quarterly basis that are much more able to be adapted given the business needs, then I think it's a much fairer way of being able to measure performance, but also a better way of making sure that what's being delivered is what the business actually needs. So I think there's a whole piece there that businesses and HR and people teams need to be exploring around how are you measuring success and what does that look like over whatever period of time you're currently looking at. And I would personally really encourage people to move away from the full year review because it's just not a reality. And all you're doing there is then creating difficult conversations with managers and employees when it comes to the end of the year, when they kind of have to go, oh yeah, we did set you this at the beginning of the year, but actually you weren't able to achieve it because business demands change. So now what do we do? So it's all a bit of a farce.
Yeah. I completely agree with you. And I think that's where sometimes HR loses its credibility, because they put in processes that just create friction at every point. Because we're sat down at the beginning of the year, you and I are discussing objectives for the year. Both of us know that those are not going to be the same in a year, but we're ticking a box.
Yep.
And then, you know, we're maybe forced to do a half year check-in and we're going, oh, well, is there a process to vary these? We'll just vary them to something else that won't be relevant at the end of the year. And therefore, you feel like you're pulling people away from something that's helping them drive work or really recognise positive behaviour. So,
yep.
You know, I think that recognition as to how HR can embrace those principles and start to break down some of those things so that the practices that HR or learning or anyone else is putting in is driven in the line of the needs of the business. Because again, you know, it's like if a learning and development team sitting down and doing an annual training needs analysis, you know, some of those annual processes, as soon as I hear the word annual in something, I'm just like, we don't live in that world anymore. We're not working in those processes, but you know, finance still have annual budgets, you know, so it's about trying to think about those more flexible ways of working, but under the principles you've talked about in Agile, which give you a structure and a reason for doing stuff, and it's all interlinked. So I think that's really helpful.
Yeah, makes sense. And even when you think about, so, you know, I've mentioned the idea of, you know, these time box sprint periods where you're perhaps working on a big project, and then the way in which you stay accountable there is you perhaps think about daily stand-ups. Well, it's no different with a manager and employee with when you're having your regular check-in. So it's much more effective to have a regular, meaningful one-to-one to track someone's progress than a biannual and an end of year review. So if you can move to a place where you're having, you know, in theory, your own little mini, a two-person stand-up where you're saying, okay, manager, employee, what's the latest? What, you know, how's your week looking? What are you working on? Where are you stuck? What blockers need to be removed? Then when you get to having sort of a longer conversation, one of the things that I just find fascinating is when you do a mid-year or end-of-year review, it's all retrospective, right? And you kind of just go through this charade of having a chat with your manager, who you kind of probably knows what you've done already over the last year, but you've got to have the meeting because HR says so. Well, why not have that meeting, but have regular checkpoints through the year that are much more meaningful? And when you have that longer term conversation, have a forward facing conversation. Talk about the year ahead rather than the year gone by. What does the year ahead look like in terms of your career ambitions or the things you want to achieve for next year, rather than an arbitrary conversation talking about stuff that you've probably covered in the year before already? It's just all a bit back to front, I think.
Yeah, no, I completely agree with you. It's like, you know, meeting friends or family once a year at Christmas and suddenly thinking, okay, we need to cover everything. And you do in that, and that's a sort of a false conversation. You're like, oh, what have we all done this year? You catch up, and then what are you going to do in the next year?
Yeah.
And that format to people that you're spending a, you know, if that was the family you lived with every day, you wouldn't sit down and have that, oh, we're sort of doing a retrospective on the year and what, it's quite false. And
yeah.
You take people from probably having, if they're not having those conversations on a daily basis, then there's a, you know, or weekly basis or every couple of days, whatever, there's a problem because you're not setting that culture in the first place. And it seems to be that was sort of a forcing managers and people to talk. And it's like, well, you should be doing that everywhere, every day.
Yeah.
So starting from the principles of, like you said, daily stand-ups and check-ins with your team and check-ins in what you're doing, removes the need for these quite false things that we need to put in. And I think some of those things that drive the challenges and sticking to traditional processes is sometimes about a need to be able to report back or show data. So I'm just interested in exploring within that agile approach, how you're showing sort of progress, reporting, contribution, all of those things and value. Because again, I sometimes think in HR or learning, we're just producing metrics because we can, or they're easy to capture, or because we force people to do them. So how can we do that better using agile methodology?
Yeah, I think it's a really good point. And I think it's one where in our profession, we need to continue to get better at. I think it goes back to this point about credibility. So to be seen as a credible business impact function, you've got to be able to show the difference and the value that you're adding to the business, rather than being order takers, process drivers, and nothing more than people policy makers. We're so much more than that. But I think I still stand by, to be able to demonstrate the impact, doing that on shorter, more regular intervals rather than waiting for the end of the year is a better way of being able to say to the business and to stakeholders in the business, these are the things that we're currently driving. So when you're looking at data, yes, you're going to have the kind of headline people metrics like labor turnover, retention, the time it takes to recruit people, all of those kind of measures. But I think we need to be much smarter and then saying, how do those measures then have an impact on the overall business performance? What is that metric doing to the bottom line of the business in terms of driving or saving revenue? And in the same way that you will have a monthly financial business review, you should really be doing something more regularly where you're looking at the people metrics to make sure you're on track. And if you're not on track, that's totally fine, because instead of leaving it for 6 months or, to the end of the year, you can do something about it much, much more quickly because you're identifying it much faster. Currently in our team, it's something we're working on. We haven't got it completely nailed yet. It's not something we've got perfect, but we're working as a team on what those data points and metrics look like so that we can truly stand by being an evidence-based team, which I think is a really important principle for all teams, really, not least HR, to be able to say that the decisions we're making and the way in which we're prioritising the work that we deliver is based on evidence-based practice, utilising data and insights so that we can be clear on why we're doing what we're doing and the impact it's having.
Yeah, and I think there's lots of principles that fall into that, being analytical in the and critical of the requests you're getting in. Again, working on projects recently, been looking at stuff, and as soon as you drill down into the data, you find that a massive issue is being made out of something that maybe is covering half a dozen people, and yet an issue that's covering 200 people is not as red flagged by the business. And it's trying to be that sort of data rational, but looking at lots of sets of data, not just hard data, but all the other things that sit in your business. And then the lead and lag indicators, which again, we tend to wait for these lag indicators to come along and say, oh, look, we happen to get something in on a, 3 monthly basis, what we find out, how has this changed? And it's almost like waiting for your lottery numbers. See, you should know in advance whether you are pushing the metrics or the levers to move those things, and whether they're moving in the right way, why they're not. And some of that daily check-in and the sprints and things like that can drive people thinking in that way more regularly. And so I think there's a whole comfort with data and with being analysed, and not just proving our worth as well. I think sometimes being able to say this hasn't worked and call out failure earlier, and being able to build budgets for experimentation. I think there's so many things that need to almost change around the edges to enable a team to get into that agile approach. So it's not easy. And, it's great to see that you're doing that, but also saying, on things like data, you're not there yet. You're still working on it. And all these things are iterative. They're going to continue to change. No one can go, we are now agile, or have now sorted this problem, because the world keeps moving.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It is. It's a constant evolution, and it's keeping on looking for where you can make those improvements. And certainly from an L&D point of view, when you're looking at, impact evidence and data, we have to move away from being satisfied that the only kind of insight that we have is based on sort of first line feedback from participants in programs saying that it was useful. I mean, it's just, that is just not okay. We have to get to a place where everybody is clear on the scale of impact L&D initiatives have in businesses, and you know, the behavioural change or the financial impact that the solution is bringing. Because I just, it pains me when I have examples where it's, you know, oh yeah, we're measuring the impact. Okay, how are we doing that? Well, we're asking delegates whether they, you know, they took something from the programme. Well, that's nice, but that's not really good enough.
Yeah, and it's interesting, you know, having been in learning development a lot of years, I'm an awful customer, because I started in L&D in a customer environment. It was in retail, and you can now see poor training. You can see poor. I can see poor process straight away when I'm a customer, and yeah. You know, my fix it head wants to go in and help them to be better, because I'm thinking that might be an individual attitudinal issue, but often it's structural, it's training, it's cultural, it's leadership. And so I think it's that curiosity from everyone in learning to want to own and see what they can do to be part of that wider team. You can't change everything, but you are a part of trying to change that impact of organization, whether it is customer satisfaction, sales acquisition, time to competence for your staff, you know, yeah, turnover, whatever it happens to be in those metrics. I strongly think L&D people should be those curious people, or HR people as well, you know, that as the whole function should be wanting to make those things work, because I think that's what makes it, well, that's what makes it interesting for me.
Yeah, agreed. And it's not only the credibility, it's having, you have to be commercially savvy in HR and L&D these days. You won't cut it unless you've got that commercial acumen to understand the impact of what you're doing and how it in turn affects the success or otherwise of the business and where you can contribute to that.
Absolutely. And we've talked a lot about Agile. What other approaches do you see as key to your success in your career?
Oh, okay. Big question. Do you know, I think what's really important is having a really broad network of people to learn from. I think this goes, you know, your question earlier on, which was what makes me slightly different because I've come through a learning and development path into the role that I do today. But I think one of the things that really taught me is you have to be continuously learning and continuously curious. We never always have all the answers. And whatever you've done in the past and what you've taken from the experience that you've got, you can to some degree apply that to the, you know, issue that you might be faced with in a current moment. But other people will have other things that they can contribute to that. So I work really hard at building out my community and my network. I know it's a bit, you know, people don't like, you know, oh, I've got to go networking, but you know, let's not make it a hard thing. It's just, you know, meeting up with people, and people that are either inspirational to you or like-minded to you that you can have really good conversations with, but also that you can build trusted relationships with. I've got some really good communities that I've nurtured and put the effort into over my career that I really value. So I feel like it's a bit of give and take. So it's about sharing your own experiences for others, because they might be able to learn from you and that might be helpful for them, but also knowing then that you can gather insights and learning from the people in your community. So I think a really important part of my career is how I've built out those communities, and I've just got huge appreciation for the amount of people that I've got that I know that I can connect into, that I would see as sort of trusted advisors, and indeed, you know, almost become friends. So it's your profession, but at the same time, you know, I've built friendships over the years that are with people that I know I can really lean on and say, God, I'm dealing with this, what do you reckon? But they equally know they can come to me and say, God, we're dealing with this, I don't know what to do, you've done something like this in the past. So that community and network piece is really, really valuable.
Yeah, I think that's key. And certainly as you move up in organisations as well, the roles become lonelier internally, because yeah, you need to have that network and support and those people you can bounce ideas from. And as you said, those trusted advisors or confidants or whatever they happen to be. I think my next question is sort of leaning upon probably a similar answer, but you've also moved from sort of different business industries, different business cultures, etc. How have you made that transition successful? Because some people will stay in one vertical for their entire career, some people move about by accident, and some people make it a deliberate part of their career to move into different industries. So how have you approached those different changes as you switch from one to another?
Yeah, mine's the latter. So mine was always deliberate. So every time I've made a career move or a job change, I've consciously wanted it to be a different sort of size and scale type organization, you know, smaller, larger, global corporate, small startup, different industries, because that for me is interesting. It creates challenge and learning. So I think if you're naturally someone that wants to be able to widen their horizons and have got that scale of curiosity, then that's a good path to take. That's not to say it's not the right thing to stay within one industry. That's totally fine. Everybody's different. And for some people, that's how they build their confidence, because they've got the knowledge of an industry and that makes them feel more confident about the role that they do. For me, I kind of need that extra stretch of taking the kind of learnings that you get from being a people professional, but then applying them in different size and scale businesses and different industries. I just find that a really interesting challenge. So I suppose then when I look at my network and my community of people that I lean on, they're all from all sorts of different environments, different sectors, different industries, different businesses, UK businesses, global businesses. So it's just a really interesting space. And I think to make that successful, you initially just need to be really open-minded. You join a new business as you would in any situation, and you need to really listen and spend time with people and understand what it is you've just arrived into, avoid making assumptions, and try and understand what the challenges are in the business that you are currently in, and work on a plan based on what they need. But yeah, for me, it's just more exciting being able to work in different spaces and different types of people and different demographics of workforces, that kind of thing.
Yeah, no, I concur. I've had a sort of very similar approach to my career that you have. And I've, you know, a few times I've come across that question of, you know, why are you coming in here? Or they only want candidates from this industry. And I often see jobs which are the first half of it is, you know, we want someone to deliver innovation, new thinking, whatever. And then the person spec is, but they must have been in the same industry, yeah. Same type of organization for 30 years. And I'm like, those two things don't necessarily match. And I think it's that, like you said, the curiosity, but it's also going in there and not just taking. I think it becomes a competency to go into new organizations and be curious, be able to know what you do know, what you need to find out, how you tap into people's existing knowledge, because you're not, you won't have necessarily industry knowledge, but you will have lots of other things you're bringing. So, you know, I think it's a really interesting career transition. You know, I've found going into new businesses because it tests your thinking, it tests your applicability. And, you know, now working with lots of organizations, I find that even more stretched. You know, in a day I'm testing my thinking three or four times working with different clients, but I personally love that. But I think, again, like you said, it's what's right for that individual. But
yeah,
if people are going in, the worst thing I've seen people do is roll out what they've done in an old organization. That is my red flag. When someone lands in my organization, is suddenly flicking through all the stuff they've done in another organization immediately to implement that. I think that to me is just, we can be so much better to go, yeah, you know, not do what we've done before. There's going to be something new and interesting and applicable to that environment and context that you can build when you land someone new.
Yeah, completely agree. The contextual piece is huge. You of course take learnings from stuff that you've delivered in previous organizations, mm-hmm, but you can't just cookie cutter solutions from one business to the next, no way. And so you've got to understand the context of the environment that you're in, take the learnings. You know, that is the whole point of evidence-based practice, right? It's data, but it's also, mm-hmm, insights and experience. So it's all of those things combined that help to inform a good decision that's going to have the most beneficial impact overall.
So what comes next for you? What's next on your horizon?
Well, we've got a busy few years at Reward Gateway, so continuing to build and grow the business. We're now working in partnership with Edenred, so we've got a lot of work going on where we're sort of bringing together two organisations that have the same goals and missions, but the way in which we do our work is quite different, as it would be with any sort of two businesses coming together. And the priority there from a team point of view is continuing to build out our employee life cycle and making sure that at an individual level, people within the business have the best possible experience with us, with, you know, real sort of personalization along the way, so that they're getting the things that they need as they grow through their career with us. So from an internal point of view, that's huge. Externally, I'm a lucky person. Like I said before, I'm a HR person and a HR business. So I actually get to grow what I love doing anyway, grow my networking community in our profession already. But I get to do that also with the amazing clients that we have within Reward Gateway. So I'm really leaning into working in partnership with our kind of sales and marketing teams with lots of client events, because whilst what we do at Reward Gateway is provide brilliant technology solutions, we also provide lots of thought partnership and inspirational thinking for HR leaders. So I get to do some really cool stuff, like going to conferences and events and hosting roundtables and webinars and all that kind of stuff. So that's really fulfilling for me and helps me grow. But I know I'm giving back to our great clients and in turn our business at Reward Gateway.
I think, you know, that's come through in the whole conversation about how that sort of passion for network, passion for the industry, passion for learning from others and sharing your learning with others. So if people have listened to this and think, actually, I want to tap into Nabil and work out how I can, you know, be part of her network or follow her thoughts, what's the best way for them to do that?
Well, social media, as it would be for everybody. So of course I'm on LinkedIn. So I share lots of updates there around some of the stuff that we're doing internally and externally at Reward Gateway. I'm on Twitter, X. Am I supposed to call it X now? I don't know. I'm on there less these days, but I do find it a useful community for information. But feel free to connect with me on Twitter. Yeah, I think probably LinkedIn is the best place. Yeah.
Okay.
I set myself up a TikTok account a while ago, but I've still not been brave enough to start sharing videos. So I've got to get on with that.
So we're not on TikTok or Instagram, but we're maybe on X and we're definitely on LinkedIn. So we'll make sure that all of those connections are in the show notes below. So I'd like to thank you very much for joining us. I really enjoyed the conversation.
Thanks for inviting me. It's been cool. Thank you.
Okay. Brilliant. Thank you, Nabil.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Learning Reinvented podcast. We hope you enjoyed it. If you've not already done so, please follow our podcast. And if the Learning Effect can help you and your organisation, please do get in touch. You can find both James and Katie on LinkedIn, and our contact details are in the show notes below.